Join Capital Group CEO Mike Gitlin on the Capital Ideas Podcast. Investment professionals reveal how they find their next great idea, what gives them their investment edge, and a few personal stories. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Capital Client Group, Inc.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.
Well, now we're joined by the Minister for Education, Norma Foley. Minister, good morning.
Good morning, Pat.
Now, a few things on our agenda. And the first is your guidance on mobile phones. And I'm struggling to see what's new. Can you explain?
Yes, well, thank you, Pat. I would accept that right across the country, the vast majority, I would say, of our schools do have a mobile phone policy in place around acceptable use of the mobile phone. But I do know in many instances, young people still have access to their phones, you know, at lunch break or at small break or whatever, or indeed during the break of class. And all of the evidence is telling us, and I hear this from staff in schools themselves, I hear it from parents, you know, many refer to the mobile phone as the scourge of the classroom. And indeed, all studies are telling us, whether it's the United Nations last year telling us that removing phones from our schools would improve learning opportunities for our children. It tackles classroom disruption and, of course, issues around cyberbullying.
OK, but offered is some guidance to schools as to what to do, but you're leaving it up to them. Some will allow the kids to keep their phones in their school bags. Some will maybe have lockers provided for them, which will allow them to access them maybe during breaks and so on. Some brave schools will say no phones from the beginning of the day to the very end until you're on your way home, then you can access your phone. So,
actually, to be more accurate there, the instruction from the Department of Education is that there will be no access to phones throughout the school day. Now, obviously, young people are free to bring the phone to school if that's the wish of their parents, or indeed, you know, and schools then will have the autonomy to decide how they will deal with that. And you're correct. Some of them will choose to say that they're in the locker, not seen and not heard throughout the entire school day, because that's the instruction from the Department of Education. And I want to be clear, as I say, great work has been done in our schools, but we need a uniformity of action here now across all of the schools. We need to develop in our schools a culture where our students have, if you like, a mental break from the mobile phones for the duration of their learning in the
academic world is at one, I think, with you on that, really they are a distraction, they're a vehicle for cyberbullying and all the rest of it. But to be quite clear, you're saying that from the beginning of the school day to the very end, there should be no access to the mobile phone through lunch breaks, whatever, no access at all until the kid is going home.
100%, yes. And if children need to be, or young people need to be contacted, obviously they can be contacted, you know, by the school secretary or whatever. If, for example, schools do have autonomy and discretion. So if, for example, a young person requires a mobile phone in terms of, you know, a medical issue or whatever, sure, that discretion is there. But the policy and how it will work in each individual school, and schools are individual, that will be created, that policy will be created in consultation, as all our policies are now, with students, parents, teachers, SNAs, the entire school staff. But I do want to say, alongside that, we will continue education in terms of digital literacy. So there in the month of May, I did launch the Literacy, Numeracy and Digital Literacy Strategy. We will continue resources into our schools via WebWise and resources of that nature. And we will also continue to fund digital infrastructure for our schools. You know, over the past few years of this government, $150 million has been paid out to schools to provide for digital infrastructure. So what we're saying is we will continue the education, we will provide the infrastructure, but specifically in terms of access to the phone during the school day, it's not necessary during the school day. And indeed, studies tell us as well that it interrupts this conversation, friendship building in schools, because we see at lunch break or whatever, young people with their noses still stuck in their phones. That doesn't foster, you know, school spirit or friendship building or whatever. And again, as I say, you know, all the studies, whether it's the US Surgeon General telling us that, for example, social media has been a major contributor to mental health issues for our young people, growing up in Ireland, studies telling us that 13-year-olds in Ireland are twice as likely to be at risk of depressive symptoms, particularly our girls, because of what happens on social media
now,
via mobile phones.
The ISSU, the representative body for student council, said mobile phones are often used during the school day for educational reasons, with junior cycle classroom-based assessments and Leaving Cert projects in subjects requiring the use of the internet. And not all schools are well-resourced with a laptop for everybody.
Well, again, I will go back to the point that more than 150 million has been given directly to schools in terms of ICT grants to ensure that they do have the infrastructure that's required in terms of digital learning and use of digital technology in our schools. And we will continue to do more in that space as well. It is not necessary for students to rely on the mobile phone in the school. And in fact, look, I've worked for many, many years myself in the education sector. I know what's happening in the schools in terms of, you know, the reliance by students themselves on the mobile phone. And I know students like to use the mobile phone. And I know they have, you know, whether that's in school or outside of school or whatever. But my point is, it is not a requirement during the school hours.
Okay.
It is not necessary for their learning during the school hours. We will continue to resource digital infrastructure for our schools as we are doing presently with over 150 million. We will do more going forward. It's not a necessary part of
their equipment. Someone else makes a point. Teachers should also have no access to their phones except when they're in the staff room, because there is, you know, recorded notion of the teacher looking at their phone while the kids all have their head down doing some designated work, and the teacher really has nothing to do except keep an eye on them, that the teacher takes out their phone and they're doing whatever they're doing on their own phone. And you've got to not say do as I say, but do as I do.
Look, again, I will say the policy as to how this will be implemented in each individual school will be constructed by the individual school. They have the right and they have the autonomy to do that. The department is issuing instruction around the access for students throughout the day. But obviously what we're seeking in the broadest instance is that there would be a culture right across our schools of no access to the mobile phone during class time and during, you know, the hours of school for our students who are, by and large, 18, 19 years of age, still within the care of the school. And obviously, I have no doubt that schools will show the appropriate leadership in that respect.
Now, the second topic is about the teacher shortage. My daughter, says a texter, is teaching in a Dublin school, loves it, but cannot afford to live. We'll be moving down the country next year after 3 years in a lovely school. It's crazy. An allowance is essential. That's from Deirdre in Waterford. What about that teacher shortage? If it becomes critical, and we're already hearing about subjects being dropped from the curriculum by some schools because of a shortage, I mean, you're the minister. What are you going to do about it?
Well, in the first instance, Pat, I would like to say that we have more than 74,000 teachers currently working and employed in our schools, the highest number of teachers ever in place. And I think that's a positive. We've seen an increase of 16% at post-primary and 10% at primary in terms of teachers working in our system. But I don't for one minute underestimate that there are challenges at different times in specific areas, and I don't underestimate the difficulty that that poses for schools. So we've introduced a number of different initiatives, whether it's the bursary of €2,000 for those who are doing the Masters in Teaching, free upskilling courses in, excuse me, high-demand courses.
But accommodation, Minister, is the key for that particular texter, and I'm sure it is for many young people who can't even find a place to rent, even if they could afford it.
Yes, indeed. And I do accept that there are challenges around accommodation. And, you know, I suppose from our point of view, what we have done right throughout this government, there have been cost of living measures introduced, whether it's, you know, rental breaks, as I've referenced there, the €2,000 for the Masters in Teaching. We're also introduced initiatives where people are free to rent out rooms in their homes with a tax break of €14,000. So more and more will be done in this space. We have in
terms of housing alone, specifically for teachers, the Dublin allowance that has been called for.
Indeed, and that has been something that has been mooted, and I've always said that nothing is, you know, entirely off the table, and we look at everything going into a budgetary cycle now. But to be fair, I think anything that would be done in terms of teachers or teaching staff at this point would perhaps have to be done across the board, whether it's those in the nursing profession or on Garda Síochána or whatever the case might be. But everything, you know, is considered, you know, as we go into a budgetary cycle. But in terms of housing in general, I want to say we have the highest number of commencements at 50,000 commencements this year, higher than anything that's been achieved in the last 10 years or so. There's a whole suite of measures in terms of housing, in terms of supports, whether it's for first-time buyers, whether it's cost rental accommodation, whether it's social housing.
They apply to everybody, not just teachers, but specifically for teachers, they have a number of gripes. For example, those who have gone off to the Middle East or whatever, and they accumulate 4 or 5 years' experience. I'm not talking about those who take leave of absence and block a job for some young teacher. I'm talking about those who maybe have done their stint overseas. They want to come back and they start at the bottom of the scale.
Well, again, just to be clear in relation to that, any teacher who works abroad, if it's in the United Kingdom or right across Europe, they are accredited when they return in terms of their service. There is an issue if they are in non-EU countries in terms of service being recognised. But, you know, we're currently looking at that to see what the potential is going forward. But I think there is a lack of understanding as regards what happens.
Yeah, but are most of them actually going to Australia or to the Middle East for their experience? So you're talking about a relatively small cohort who might go to Spain or Portugal or the UK. You're really talking about the huge number who go for the big money and relatively tax-free money in the Middle East. That's the big cohort, and they won't come back because they can't see an opportunity at an appropriate rate of pay.
Well, again, I would say to you, it's always been a case, and as is people's right, it is always the rights of people to travel if that's what they would wish to do, or indeed if they feel they have to go. But by and large, we are providing that resource for them if they do come back in terms of accreditation. But there is an issue, as you have said, in some instances where they're in non-EU countries. We're currently looking at that. But I think we must also be clear that, you know, there can also be a push and pull factor. You know, we must recognise those that have stayed behind as well.
And do you think they'd be resentful of somebody being parachuted in at a higher rate of pay, having come back from the Middle East or whatever, that there'd be resentment
well, again,
there?
I'm just making the point in terms of this level of equity and fairness. We must look at the push and pull factors. We must recognise, and we have recognised up to a point, as I said, right across the UK and right across Europe, the service of others. In many instances, I suppose, in systems that are in some areas are akin to our own, but in systems that are not, you know, we're currently looking to see if there is scope there. But again, we must be fair to all concerned.
The question of leave of absence and people going away for multiple years, I know there are rules around it, but it seems a bit ridiculous that people can vanish for long periods of time and then reclaim a job. But I'm going to park that issue for the moment because there's one more very critical issue. We'll be talking to Brian Mooney after 10. And this is the question of grade inflation and the possibility that people might take legal action against your department because they will feel they are being discriminated against. Next year's cohort will have less grade inflation than this year, and yet this year's and last year's competing students will have an advantage. It doesn't seem fair.
Well, just to be clear, I suppose, and sometimes we have to cast our minds back to where we were in the height of COVID, as it were. So in the years of COVID, it was necessary to find a pathway forward for our Leaving Certificate students so that they would have a passport to go into the world of work or further education or apprenticeship or higher level education or whatever. So that was done via the calculated grades and then the accredited grades.
Yeah, I think we're familiar really with the history of this, but the issues that come up this year, for example, people getting into courses by random selection, even though they've maximum points. How fair is that? You work your butt off for 5-6 years in the second level system, you get maximum points and you find you're in a raffle. I mean, how fair is that?
But if I could just clarify, because I appreciate what you're saying, that we all know about what happened in the past, but I think it's very easy to forget the impact that it had on students at that time. So we are dealing currently today with interrupted learning for students. So during that time, there was an uplift. Teachers and schools provided the accredited or calculated grades. There was an inflation of in and around 7%. So to be fair to the students at that time who were taking the exams and those that came after it, the 7% uplift on aggregate was provided for those students, and that was fair. Now, this particular cohort that did the Leaving Cert this year, the Leaving Certificate class of 2024, 80% of those students did not sit a state exam. So again, they were highly impacted by COVID, so that 7% or 7.5% uplift on aggregate was provided for them. I have indicated that as we go forward next year, and you've referenced it, that that grade inflation will come down by a small percentage year on year to level the playing pitch to pre-COVID times. And again, that's fair. If my son or daughter were taking Leaving Certificate this year, I would have wanted the maximum of fairness for that young person. And so that was provided
for
this year.
Next year, three years hence, when it's all gone, you'll have people still eligible to apply on their CAO from 2024 for courses, and they will have 7% more points than an equivalent person in 3 years' time. That's the issue. And again, that business of the raffle for a place in a course for which you are completely qualified with your points.
And again, just to clarify on that, two things were done for the classes, for the students in the last number of years. One was that accommodations were made on the paper. Generally, the exam papers, they were given greater choice. And secondly, there was that uplift of 7.5%. In relation to going forward, the last cohort of students this particular year were the last to be impacted in terms of not taking state exams. So going forward, for example, in 25, I've announced that the accommodations on the paper will remain in place. In other words, for the class of 2025, they will have the same accommodations as this year's students, greater choice. But the uplift that they will get will be a slight percentage lower than what previous years have received.
We've heard the rules, but the question is, in terms of a possible legal challenge to this whole regime, are you talking to the CAO to help to get them to help you design something, or between the two of you, the department and the CAO, that will avoid legal challenge?
Well, again, look, I think legal challenge, people have a right to do, you know, what they would wish to do. But I think if you look at this in the broadest sense, it was necessary to intervene to ensure the students had a passport forward. It was necessary in terms of fairness that there would be a similarity of uplift and conditions for all of the students. And we're unravelling that now, the further and further and further.
But are you talking to the CAO to try and devise something that will avoid legal challenges?
Well, my department engages on an ongoing basis with the Department of Further and Higher. We do not control, as you will appreciate, the CAO or the central applications process. That's not a matter for the Department of Education. That's run by the colleges. And perhaps, you know, going forward, I would be clear that there needs perhaps to be a new and a fresh look taken at the CAO application process, particularly for the high demanding courses. But on that one, I want to be very clear, you know, numerous new places have been made available right across the country. For example, last year alone, an additional 600 places in the area of healthcare were announced. And I want to acknowledge the work of Minister O'Donovan and indeed Minister Donnelly from a health point of view in terms of places being made available. So that's in, you know, nursing, or it's in the therapy, speech and language, or occupational therapy or whatever.
And that should have an impact on the points. All right. Minister, it's just after 10, so we have to leave it there. Minister for Education, Norma Foley. Thank you very much for joining us.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.
The Capital Ideas podcast now features a series hosted by Capital Group CEO Mike Gitlin. Through the words and experiences of investment professionals, you'll discover what differentiates their investment approach, what learnings have shifted their career trajectories, and how do they find their next great idea? Invest 30 minutes in an episode today. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Published by Capital Client Group, Inc.